Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and delighted to have everybody with us today. Today, Robin and I are going to be talking with another woman who has been diagnosed with kidney cancer. And kidney cancer is one of those cancers that is more prevalent amongst men. So it's somewhat unusual, not extraordinarily so, but somewhat unusual for a woman to be diagnosed with kidney cancer. So we'll talk with her in just a minute. And meanwhile, just want you to know whose voice is whose. So I'm Joyce Graff, and Robin Martinez is on the phone from Colorado. Hi, Robin. Robin, are you on? We were having some connection problems, so there's a possibility that Robin's voice is not quite on yet. So let me introduce Karen Gibson. Karen is from Florida, and welcome, Karen. We're great to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Joyce. I'm glad to have this opportunity to share.
Great, great. So tell us a little bit about your adventure with kidney cancer. I understand that you had an interesting diagnostic experience.
Well, it sure was. I was, again, as the statistics say, mostly men. I was so surprised to have been diagnosed in 2005. So I'm a 12-year survivor so far, and I'm very appreciative of that, as you can imagine. But I actually did feel a little, I could palpitate a little hard lump on the left side in the front under my rib cage, and I could feel it on occasion, but had no other symptoms. I didn't do anything about it. I just put it off. And when I was at my regular annual evaluation, I brought it to the attention of my doctor, and she could palpitate it as well. And she said, "Let's get an ultrasound." And from there, that's where the journey started. She called me the next day. They had found a 13-centimeter mass and told me to go get my records. And immediately, because of the size, we knew it needed to come out regardless of what it was. And so that's how it all started. And the journey was that this may happen to many people, but trying to find the right doctor, wanting to get to an expert, and they're out of your insurance network and that sort of thing. So having to work through trying to find who to go see and how to pay for all this and just the initial shock of the reality of having a cancer diagnosis. I think that in the beginning it was very difficult.
Sure. So let's just check. Is Robin, are you on the line now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yay.
Yay. I can hear you.
Hi, Karen. Yeah.
Hello.
So when was your diagnosis?
I was diagnosed in June of 2005. I was 46.
You've been dealing with this for quite a while now.
Quite a while now. Yeah.
It does get a little less terrifying as we get our sea legs, so to speak.
Yes, I agree. And I tried to, my hopes by sharing is to maybe put the rest to some others that may be newly diagnosed that, you know, there is a chance you may live long term and don't give up hope
and don't let the fear
get in your way.
The general oncologist that most people see first, or the general doctor, often has a very gloomy prognosis, and we have people who've had a gloomy prognosis live for years and years and years.
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
but I think one of the things I wanted to underscore is that, you know, we know our own bodies better than our doctors do, and we're with them a lot more than the 12 minutes per year that we're often allocated with our doctors. So when you find a lump and you know something is unusual, Don't ignore it. I mean, sometimes things come and go in the course of a month, but if it's there for more than a month, then you should raise it in conversation with your doctor. And I was glad to hear that your doctor had followed it up with a scan, because those scans are really wonderful. They can tell what's going on inside your body without cutting you open or doing anything dramatic. So they really are a wonderful advance in medicine.
And I agree with what you're saying, that we have to take care of our, be in tune to our bodies, because I do look back at that time and I could have easily have put up off my doctor appointment, because as we all do at times, when you feel okay, you think, oh, I'll put it off. And then also she could have easily have said, well, keep an eye on it and we'll look at it next time in a year, give your next physical. So I agree 100%. That's what I've, a big learning thing for me, that I really listen and follow your gut and do something about it. You're part of the team with your doctor.
Right, so. And often we're so frightened by what we find ourselves that when the doctor says, oh, well, it's probably nothing, it's very reassuring to us and we'd like to believe it. And instead of pushing to get it checked out, we get lulled into this false sense of security. We really should say, well, just in case, could we look into it farther?
Exactly.
And not
right.
be scared of it.
And not be afraid of a second opinion, possibly, if you don't agree with that doctor's opinion of just waiting. Don't be afraid or offending to offend anybody, because as we know now with kidney cancer, the time is at the essence, so we don't want to wait too long.
Right, and it's a lot better to know that it's there and to be dealing with it than it is to be going off, la, 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 everything is fine, and then find out later on, well, your suspicions were correct, your own suspicions as the patient were correct, and there was something very serious wrong, and the doctor's cavalier, oh, it's probably nothing, really didn't help you.
Right. So
now, how big was your mass when it was discovered?
Now, I did have a 13-centimeter tumor, so that was,
right.
I guess, fairly large. And
tell me. I know we Americans don't think well in centimeters, but I know from knitting that 10 centimeters is 4 inches, so 13 centimeters was more or less 5 inches. That's a big tumor. That's a softball.
Exactly, and that, I think what I was feeling, the lump that I felt was not even actually the tumor. I think it was pushing against other organs, and that was just coming forward. And so I don't really know, but that's, I'm just guessing on that. But so, and I was told at that time that the odds.
So, Karen, I'm not hearing you. I'm going to turn off your microphone and back on again, and we'll hope that that solves the problem. So, Karen, are you back on? Okay. So, Karen, you may need to dial back in again. Let's just talk, you and I, Robin, here for a minute. So when you have a kidney cancer tumor, one of the things that we've learned about the behavior of kidney cancer tumors is that they usually are safe to watch up to about 3 centimeters or about 1 inch. After that, the risk that it's going to metastasize and go elsewhere in your body and do nasty things to you, that risk begins to go up. And there's no magic number at which it definitely goes off, but the risk keeps going up. So that's why it's best to pay attention to these things as early as possible in the cycle.
Right, and one thing most people don't know about cancer is that cancer is usually painless until it gets to a pretty drastic stage. So if you start feeling pain and say, oh, well, maybe I should go get checked out, you will wish you were checked out much, much earlier. My husband had a massive kidney cancer tumor and had no pain. He had a little mild sensation when he leaned back on the car seat, like something was pressing against him. But it didn't hurt. It was just, oh, that's a little odd. There's no lump in the car seat. And he had no symptoms whatsoever other than that and feeling a little tired until one day his urine was just blood. And that's what got him to go to the doctor. But if he'd waited for pain, he would be dead.
Mm-hmm. Karen, are you back? Okay, Karen, I'm going to disconnect your line. Please reconnect, and then we can edit this out later. Okay. So, yeah, so early intervention is critically important in all cancers and kidney cancer in particular. But as these things grow, then sometimes they're still inside the kidney. They're just this little, like a marble or something like that. And at that point, we say that they're well encapsulated. But then sometimes they reach out little tentacles. They start going outside the kidney capsule. And each one of those is a danger signal that this thing is beginning to act in some aggressive manner. And so that's why we need those images. You know, the doctors used to have to open you up. They called it exploratory surgery. But these days we have all these.
I was just thinking the same thing. How fortunate we are to have the scans today, because they don't have to cut us open just to see what's going on.
Right. So we've got the ultrasound, as she said, which is one of the least expensive and usually pretty readily available. But it is somewhat dependent on the skill of the operator. Does the operator know how to find not only the kidney, but the tiny little tumors inside the kidney? And so sometimes you need a CT or an MRI, and they're more expensive, but they're wonderful imaging techniques, and they show you a lot about what's going on.
Right, and so often nowadays, it's interesting, since kidney cancer has so few symptoms in the early stages, now when people, for example, get in a minor car wreck, and maybe there's internal injuries that we don't see, so a CT scan is done, say, in the emergency room. And while they're looking at the CT, they notice, hey, there's something going on in the kidney. Now, that's a good thing that they noticed it. But the scary thing is, a lot of times they'll write on the report, no internal injury. However, there's a small mass noted on the kidney. You should, as the patient, you should look at the report yourself, because it's very easy for your doctor to just glance at that report when it's passed along to your regular doctor and say, oh, there was no internal injury, and just stop. But if you read the whole report, you'll find there was a mass noted, and you have to pursue that. And if your doctor doesn't notice it, it's up to you to notice it.
Right, and that sort of swift action is very important. And then, of course, the next step is finding someone who's going to actually help you do something about this. And it may or may not be your local doctor. Robin, what's your experience with that?
Well, you start with the local doctor, of course, and with ours, the ER was the one who picked up the mass, which was definitely not something you could ignore at that point. And we had an HMO coverage, so we really didn't have much choice where to go at that point. Fortunately, the urologist that we got was fantastic. And at first, it looked like this mass was inoperable, but as we pursued it, he said, I can take that out, and he did. And they literally at the hospital were calling my husband the miracle man. Really, it was the doctor who was the miracle man, because he dealt with something that looked totally inoperable and got it out. And my husband was cancer-free for about 2.5 or 3 years after that. But then it metastasized. And when your kidney cancer metastasizes, you really need to go beyond the general oncologist who's available in your hometown, unless you happen to live someplace like Boston, where your hometown is a major center. you want to go to somebody who's a really well-known expert in kidney cancer, because the oncology of kidney cancer is very different from the oncology of, say, breast cancer or lung cancer or the cancers that are seen much more commonly.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, Karen, what was your experience with finding an expert to deal with?
Well, it's interesting because when I was first diagnosed, I was seeing just a regular primary care doctor. So she then referred, when we found the mass, she referred me then to a local urologist. So that's who actually told me the news or gave me the news. And then he told me about a colleague of his at that time in 2005. I guess the robotic surgery was just a new and upcoming thing around the corner. And he was telling me about the Mayo Clinic that's in my area. I know there's many areas now that do this sort of procedure, but at that time for me, that was the local facility, and he felt that might be worth investigating to see if I would be a candidate. And it ends up, because of the size of the tumor, they could not do it via the laparoscope or robotically. But I did confer with that doctor, and he ultimately did a radical nephrectomy. But it was, you know, you do, and what I've learned ever since is we do need the top people. You can't go to you really do need to go to an expert in the field. And so
right.
Then I had some issues with my insurance, and that's a whole nother subject. But, you know, I came to a point where, should I go there? It's out of my network. Should I not? And I made the decision to go, and that was kind of a financial drain, but we got through it, and part of the journey.
Yes. And one of the reasons you want to seek out an expert is because this is a field that is moving very, very, very rapidly. So 12 years ago, there was surgery and not a lot else, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the last five or 10 years, we've been getting a whole bunch of new drug therapy options. And there are now, more than 8 drugs on the market?
There are 11.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Right. And it keeps going up. And, of course, there's also experimental drugs. But as you point out, when Karen was first diagnosed, there was surgery and there was interleukin-2. If you had the right kind of kidney cancer, and if you were fit enough, and if your doctor happened to be experienced enough to say you've got a drug available to treat your cancer, then maybe you got interleukin-2 and maybe it worked. But today we have 11 approved drugs. This is an amazing change.
It is, and it doesn't help the fact that a lot of them have similar names, and they all, you know, it's confusing to the patient. They have all different types of ways that they work, and so the navigating through all this, it's important that we share like we're doing.
Right. And
well, and not only for the patient, but it's confusing for many of the doctors because they're not dealing with it every day, and so dealing, should I choose drug A, B, C, or D? Sounds like just a question on an exam, but the people, the top oncologists in the country, and there are maybe 5 or 10 of them, literally that few, that are keeping up with this on a daily basis, they're the people you really want to help you select the right therapy. So I know, Robin, you have a lot of experience with this. Go for it.
Yes, unfortunately, I do have a lot of experience with it, and this is where I'd like to put in a comment about smartpatients.com. This is the place where kidney cancer patients start without knowing anything, and within 6 weeks, they know all the drugs that are available to them. They know the names of any top experts in their area. They know the names of the top experts in the world. And they have guidance from experienced patients who can help them get all this information, get up to speed really fast so that people know what their choices are, where their choices are, who to consult with, how to consult long distance if you can't travel. where you want to travel if you can travel, where clinical trials are, where surgeons are, all this information that people have after they've dealt with this, dealt with kidney cancer for 10 years. When you're first coming into it, you don't know who to ask, you don't know anything, and your local doctor probably doesn't know very much, unfortunately, because they have so much to keep up with. There are changes all throughout cancer today, and no doctor can be expected to keep up with all of the changes that are happening, but the experts in kidney cancer keep up with the changes in kidney cancer, and that's why you want to see them.
Yes, so important. I just agree 100%.
Judy, Karen, you've uh-huh. been dealing with a number of people in your local area where you provide some patient support. What kinds of questions come up amongst the people that you deal with?
Okay, most people that call this local support group, I've been involved with the Judy Nicholson Foundation and also others, and sometimes you just run into somebody on the street and their brother or somebody had it, and you just get into a conversation. So I just enjoy having that conversation and sharing information with people, regardless of where we are, what's happening. But as far as you mean the questions that they ask in particular, I guess they're mostly newly diagnosed, and they're kind of in the fear stage, I think. Most
sure.
patients are looking for just information on what to do next. And I think it is because, like you're saying, there's so many options now and it's confusing. Well, why are they... They're telling me I need to do this, and why aren't we doing this? And they just don't know enough yet to understand about the first-line treatments, the second-line treatments, and
right.
how the immunotherapies work. And so it's all just so foreign, and they're just bewildered. They just had a 20-minute appointment with their doctor, and the doctor is it's just like with the deer in the headlights. And so those are the types of, I guess, questions and concerns at first, but I have been talking to some other patients that are along, not at stage 2 or 3, or actually in the stage 4 where I'm at, and are still looking into new different treatments, and we try to share that information as things go along and we try to network patients together with similar diagnosis and treatment plans.
This is another place, two points. One is, if you have somebody in your family, this might be your spouse, it might be your daughter, it might be your parent, who is good at picking up medical terminology and good at gathering information, and maybe they want something to do to relieve their anxiety about your situation, then
mm-hmm.
you can concentrate on going through the surgery, which is usually the initial action. And you can concentrate on getting through that and recovering from surgery while they're gathering information for you. And that helps a lot. The caregiver can become the repository of who and when and where and what while you're healing. And another thing is that there are so many different kinds of kidney cancer now. Renal cell carcinoma has several different divisions, plus many genetic syndromes. And to know exactly what kind you're dealing with and the nuances of that, that's pretty deep information that you're going to want to talk to other people who've been dealing with this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't have to start from scratch. There's no sense reinventing the wheel. Depend on other people.
Exactly. And you should definitely look to that resource.
Well, let me just back up one second here and define some terms, because people who are not familiar with oncology may be wondering what we're talking about in terms of the cell types. The traditional oncology was basically to give you a poison that they infuse into your system that targets the cells in your body that grow the fastest, which includes cancer. It also happens to include your hair follicles. And so that's why in traditional chemotherapy, people tend to lose their hair. So, and that's a kind of systemic treatment where they're just like a shotgun looking for fast-growing cells somewhere in your body. But the new therapies are what they call targeted therapies, and they're going after a particular mechanism deep inside the cell. And these mechanisms are different depending on what particular cell type of cancer you happen to have. And it's interesting because some of these cell types are related even if they're in different organ systems. So, for example, kidney cancer and lung cancer have a lot in common. So some of the same drugs that work well with kidney cancer also work well with lung cancer. So the oncologists understand all these intricacies. Your normal GP might deal with one or two cases a year. The oncologists are dealing with dozens of cases on a daily basis. And so that's why you need that fresh look, that expertise of the people who are keeping up with it.
So true.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially with these, now that we have 11 drugs in kidney cancer that are approved by the FDA specifically to treat kidney cancer, these drugs work in different ways. They have different side effects. They work for different people. And having a doctor who knows the nuances among all these 11 drugs is really important. Because you don't want to get somebody who it's their very first time prescribing this drug.
That's right. Right.
Well,
then there's also some, I was going to say, some terminology, too, with these things that I think are important for patients to learn about, such as just OS, overall survival, and...
progression-free survival
yeah.
is the other
lingo.
One. The PFS, the lingo
yes.
that they use to describe the effectiveness of these yeah. various drugs. And Karen, I know you've been down this path too. That they'll start you on drug A, so whatever its name is. This is your first line therapy because it's the first one that you've had. And if that one continues to work, then you may stay on that for a long time. But sometimes the drugs stop working after a year or so, and at that point there's some decisions to be made. One of them might be to change the dosage, the level of the drug or the schedule that you get on the drug. Sometimes that kind of a change up will help. And sometimes you go to a different drug, which now is called your second line therapy. So you want to talk to that a little bit?
Sure. And then that's exactly where I am at, Joyce. I have never been on any kind of systemic treatment or first-line treatment until I guess it was 2012. So all that time, all I had was, the surgery and then the watch and wait and the scans and, of course, I think they call it surveillance. It's another terminology. But I had the recurrence, and I did have several surgeries. And since it just kept about the third time out, we realized these surgeries are just holding it off. And really, I wanted to get on to something systemic, so I approached the doctor and. Yes, I've done very well. Knock on wood. It is a first line targeted therapy, oral treatment. Started on every 4 weeks with a 2 week off dosage schedule, and I was on that a good year. And it's one of these things that accumulates. I did have some side effects, not very good, but I. I was able to work through them. But finally, now I have reduced my dosage down and my scheduling. So I'm still on the same drug, and I guess it is a lower dosage amount, and I've changed it my scheduling where I take it every 2 weeks and then 1 week off, and that has helped. So it's good to know. I think patients need to know that, you know, that sometimes when they're on a drug, you know, try it. You don't know. It may work. It may not. And I know there's risks with it, but, you know, you can tweak it. You can tweak it. And the doctors are there to work with you, and the nurses are there. They're great with working with you with your side effects. And then you kind of get to know, okay, I'm going to be having maybe some tenderness to the bottoms of my feet. That's one of the side effects, the neuropathy. And so you just learn to do things. And so that's my experience with the drug. I am told that this drug, again, there is no cure, and that the odds for it to recur are there, and they're pretty high. So I'll be continued to be monitored for the next, I guess, forever, really, until right now I'm considered stable. Unless
Great.
I have progression. Yeah, and then unless I have progression, we'll talk about a second-line treatment. But there is a fine line where they may or may not put you on a second-line treatment, depending on your other health issues, such as blood pressure. That's one side effect that I've had to deal with and may restrict me from participating in other treatments. So mm-hmm. there's that
on
other balance.
On the other hand, once you stop this treatment, your blood pressure might go back to normal. This is an area where it's really important to be, again, in the hands of an expert, because a doctor who really knows the ins and outs of treating with that particular drug that you're talking about, which I happen to recognize, normally, if it's given by a general oncologist, and the statistics will tell you, oh, you have probably, if it works for you, you probably have 11 to 15 months of effectiveness with this drug. But in the hands of someone who knows how to manipulate the dosage schedule, and deal with the side effects, we know people who've been on this particular drug for 9 to 12 years and maintained its effectiveness and been able to cope with the side effects because the doctor was persistent and innovative and knew how to handle the drug.
So I'm in the learning. I think I have a wonderful doctor, and I'm in that learning curve. We're learning to adjust my blood pressure medication according to my blood pressure readings every day, before we weren't doing that daily. And so we're getting a better handle of it. And it does. The idea is to keep, so that will keep you on the medication. And so far, I've had stability now for, I guess it's almost been a year and a half. So I think I'm at the end of that time frame that they were saying that normally works. But I'm going to continue to hang in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because there are people who've had long-term success with drugs that, for most people, they move on at the end of a year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
To a different drug. And if your doctor knows how to manipulate it, and if you are willing to work with your doctor on manipulating it and trying different approaches with the same drug, as I said, some people have had 9 to 12 years of success with this drug, which is fantastic.
It is. And the idea is to stay on it, and then hopefully by then or before then we'll have, you know, a better
right.
treatment to go to that will have less side effects, so your quality of life is still maintained. You know, that's where the
right.
real balance comes in.
Right, because even though there are some side effects with these newer drugs, these side effects are nowhere on the scale of what we think of in the old-fashioned kind of chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. So they usually are things that we can live with. You know, nausea, you take a pill for nausea, it manages it. So I don't want to trivialize it. Some of them are very minor like that. Some of them are a little bit more. But the nurses and the patients have learned better ways of coping with it, which I know is one of the topics in Smart Patients.
Right, and one of the things that so many patients don't realize is you have to keep pushing with the doctor and the nurse and your friends to get information on how to handle these side effects. Don't just suffer in silence. Don't just say, "Oh, everybody has terribly sore feet and throws up all the time and has to run to the bathroom every 10 minutes for diarrhea." You can cope with those things if you are getting the right side effect treatments. But if you don't say to the doctor, "This isn't working for my side effect," the doctor doesn't know.
Exactly.
And so you have to keep pushing. You have to keep dealing. It's like having an intermittent car problem.
Exactly.
You wouldn't just say, "Oh, well, every so often my car isn't going to start," or, "Oh, well, every so often it's going to do this or that." You keep pushing, and you keep asking different mechanics, and you keep trying different solutions. The same thing is true with your body when you're on a cancer drug. You need to keep trying different things and pursuing solutions, and don't just say, "Oh, I have to suffer."
Exactly, and especially... There's two things that happened with me in regards to some of the side effects. I did have some diarrhea, but I just thought, okay, like you're saying, it's just a normal side effect and it'll go away. And I didn't, I mean, now I know to take Imodium, but since it was just sporadic, I really wasn't treating it. And what happened then, I became dehydrated. And then the dehydration affected my kidney function. So it's so important that, you know, one thing, that little thing will lead to the other. And also I had some, it does cause some bleeding, I guess. I guess that's like just under the arms and bruising. And I had some bleeding and things like that, just small areas. But you can have to make sure that they're clean and they, because if those get infected, little sores here and there, or mouth sores or anything, then that all leads to a whole other thing. So it's a lot to keep on top of, but it's doable if you do, and to not give up.
And there are so many little remedies that people don't know about. Like, there's a prescription drug called Gelclair for mouth sores that most people don't know about. Most doctors don't even know about it. And for diarrhea, one of the things that our people on Smart Patients have found and recommended to each other is for some people, eating macaroons, coconut macaroons.
Oh my goodness, I've never heard of that.
I know.
But I will try it.
Some people, macaroons are great for this. And you eat a couple in the morning and a couple in the evening, and it controls your diarrhea. Now, for other people, it makes their diarrhea worse. So you have to try it. And see if it helps. If it helps you, great.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's a low-cost, home-based thing that you can do. And as I said, if it works for you, fantastic.
Right.
Well,
and
we should also hasten to say that this is a team sport. You know, you make sure that your doctor and your nurse are in on anything that you think you want to experiment with, just to make very sure that there's nothing that's going to interfere with the action of the drug. I mean, grapefruit comes to mind. It seems like grapefruit's a healthy thing, but it does interact badly with some of the drugs.
Exactly.
So you want to make sure that everybody is talking together and working together to keep you as comfortable and to keep the drug as successful as possible for you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and another thing is, while we're talking about getting information from these many sources and depending on other people, do be careful not just to, you know, "My cousin's brother had the same thing," or, "My cousin's brother had cancer and he did this and he did that and it worked for him." you don't want to just get remedies from people who have dealt with cancer. You need things from kidney cancer. Kidney cancer is different from almost every other kind of cancer. So when you find somebody who's got experience in your kind of kidney cancer, ask them where they got information, and share their information and pass it along to other patients. But don't just take things from your cousin's brother's aunt.
Yes. And I agree, because you're also talking about the other kidney. I guess most of us have either had a kidney removed entirely or partial, but I do, you know, you have to keep in mind then you want to maintain a good kidney health there. So
yes,
you've got to be careful with these interactions and things too. So that's all,
right.
You know, another point
we
there.
We should probably say a word or two about the new immunotherapy drugs, too, because there's a lot of hype and a lot of hope in the immune therapy drugs. The philosophy of those drugs is to bolster your own immune system so that your body will attack the cancer and do away with it. It's a great hope. It is working for some patients. I think that around 10 to 15% of the people who are taking the immunotherapy drugs are getting a very good response. So the response is still relatively low, but it's a very hopeful new area. But the reason I wanted to raise it is that some of the side effects that can occur with the immunotherapy drugs need a very different approach than the side effects that happen with other targeted therapies. And so, again, you need to be talking to your team and not taking advice from random sources, because it may or may not be a good thing with some of the new immune therapy drugs.
That's true. Yes, you're right. That's a great point.
Absolutely. The treatment for the side effects for immune therapy, the big thing about it is that you really have to stay on top of them and you have to report them immediately to your doctor, which is different from, oh, I threw up yesterday, but that was pretty normal. When you're on an immune therapy, you have to watch for any little symptom. And even if it just seems like, oh, I've got a cold, or, oh, my stomach is upset, you need to talk to your doctor right away. It could be something more serious than you think.
Right.
And also, I was going to say, I know we're running out of time a little bit here, but I just if I could ask a question to you, Robin, or Joyce, about the new combination therapies. I guess that's the new, another new and up and coming thing, I guess, but that is similar to the immunotherapy, but in side effects.
Right. So there are a number of trials going on worldwide where they're trying to take an immune therapy drug and add to it one of the targeted therapy drugs, and hopefully there'll be a synergistic effect. Sometimes that has worked well. Sometimes it has worked badly. So there's a lot of experimentation going on. And you need to just stay close to your own team. Whatever trial you're on, they will be working with the patients on that trial to try to optimize what's happening or decide that it's not a good idea. I mean, whenever you're on a trial, some of those are going to be successful and some of them are not. And whatever learning comes out of it is important learning, even the one that says, this was not such a great idea.
Right.
Robin, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, it seems like the new immunotherapy drugs, the PD-1 drugs and the PD-L1 drugs, are working better in combination with almost anything. So the trick is to find the best combination. And one of the best combinations that they've found so far is to use one of the new immunotherapies with another type of immune checkpoint blocker that blocks CTLA-4, and this is called Yervoy or ipilimumab, and we call it Ipi.
Okay.
Ipi with nivolumab has gotten results in about 40% of patients. Now, that sounds great. That's a big improvement. and it like doubles, it doubles the response rate of nivolumab alone. But the big issue with it is that the side effects are also doubled, and about half the people end up needing to go to the hospital to treat the side effects. Now, the good news is, if you act quickly on the side effects, the treatment for the side effects is fantastic, and it can pull you back out of them. And then they take you off one of the other drugs for a while, and they watch you, and then they reintroduce your treatment drugs as necessary. And an exciting thing of this is that the immunotherapy drugs can sometimes have effects after you stop the drug. So you take a drug, it doesn't look like it's working, you stop the drug, and all of a sudden it kicks in and your immune system is responding perfectly and your cancer might entirely go away.
So we're going to have to sign off at this point. We are going to be out of time. And there's always more to learn. We hope that you'll join us on Smart Patients or work with one of the good patient advocacy groups in your own area, as Karen does in Florida. And be with us some more. We'll talk more about this and many other interesting topics as we go forward. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.
You too, Joyce. Thank you.